The talk this evening is a request, and I love requests which are just given to me at the last minute so I don't have to think about them. Because thinking about what you're going to do is really a pain between the ears. I hate planning things, simply because whenever you plan things, they still go wrong anyway. So it's best not to plan and allow them to go wrong. You'll have a much easier life. And even though to find out what I'm doing, sometimes I get on the website and find out where is Ajahn Brahm, so I understand where I'm supposed to be. There's no jokes, it's true, there's no jokes sometimes. Sometimes I wake up in the morning, the first thing I have to do is look around, what country are you in? And then only in the morning I get my plan for the day, what I'm supposed to be doing. But if I look at it the day before, I go crazy, I can't do that. Have you ever done that? You know, you look at what you're supposed to do today and that's impossible. It's just too much. But then actually just when you do it, it's very easy. That's one of the things I learned. This has nothing to do with the talk. The talk is like how to be a Buddhist in a country which isn't Buddhist, or with people who aren't Buddhists, who in a family which isn't Buddhist, in a workplace which isn't Buddhist. Now, how do you get on with this? You know, trying to be a Buddhist when everyone around you isn't, and they're indulging doing all sorts of silly things which you don't want to do, but you're their friend, so what should you do? But just going back, that's the title of the talk, but going totally off the subject about sort of not planning things. That was one of the stories which changed much of the way I looked at my life. You know, much of the training I had as a young monk, it wasn't like coming to a lecture like this and being told what to believe. It wasn't like reading from books. It was actually listening to life and understanding from a few things you were taught about how to solve the problems of life, the real problems, the difficulties which each one of us face from time to time. And this was the story of young monk over in Thailand and Ajahn Chah, my teacher. He was building his main hall, you know, the main sala, they call it, the main sort of Dharma hall. And he'd actually finished the construction of the building, but it was actually on this hill. There's a lot of earth left over. They regarded the young monks not just as people who you would teach, but also as a free labor force. So we were actually exploited. I would only wished I'd have known someone like Kevin Reynolds when I was very young, and I'd have told him about this, and I'm sure he'd have made some suggestions about not working so hard. Because what we used to do, when Ajahn Chah got us all together just after the meal, which we'd finished our one meal a day about 9:30, really early in the morning, and after that was finished, he said, look, we've got this big pile of earth over here. It's a mess. So we want all the monks to actually to move it. And he showed us where he wanted it to go. And he had a point. It was a mess all over the place. And you know, even as a young monk, I believed in the law of karma. And it's nice to actually to help and do good things for others, especially do good things for a monastery and a temple. That's really good karma. So, yes, I said, I'm enthusiastic. I'll do that. I didn't have any choice anyway, so I did it. And so for 3 days it took us to move this earth from 9:30 in the morning to about 8, 9 o'clock at night. You know, when it got very dark, they had these lanterns. We were shoveling earth and pushing wheelbarrows. And of course it was like really hot climate and, you know, sticky, not like the dry heat of Perth, but, you know, it's tropics in jungle. And pushing these wheelbarrows of earth, dirty, sweating, tired on one meal a day, bitten by mosquitoes, and of course at the end of the day you had a quick shower and then you crashed out. And you're so tired. And that went for 3 days. And after 3 days we finally finished. And that night Ajahn Chah went away to another monastery. Just, you know, like I go over to Sri Lanka and Thailand and Malaysia, Indonesia, Hong Kong, all these places. And that's what monks do, we spread ourselves around. So he went off for 3 days. And the next morning, after the meal, the deputy abbot, the number two, he called all us monks together and he said, look, I think we put the earth in the wrong place. And you know, he did have a point. He said, it'd be much better over here. So for the next 3 days, we were pushing wheelbarrows in the hot, sticky climate, being bitten to death by mosquitoes, really tired. But you know, I still had inspiration. You know, if it's for a good cause, you can work much harder than if you're being paid for money. So I really worked hard, and 6 days were over, and I was really exhausted. I needed to wash all my clothes, wash my body. I want to do some meditation and catch up on sleep and all these other things you're supposed to be doing. So I was really pleased we'd finished. Unfortunately, that night, Ajahn Chah came back. And after the meal that morning, you've guessed, he called all the monks together and said, "Look, you put it in the wrong place. I told you to put it over here. Why did you move it over there? Move it back again." And you know, everybody only has so much faith. And I'd exhausted mine. And I thought, you can't do this to us. You know, look, why don't you guys, you know, you leaders, you bosses, why don't you beforehand decide where you want this blooming earth? I didn't say blooming, I was about to say something else, but why don't you decide where you want to put this earth before you ask? Because you guys don't push the wheelbarrows, you don't shovel the earth, you're just sitting there under your huts talking to people all day, having a great time. It's really unfair. And I was really upset. Another 3 days of hard work. That's not what I became a monk for. I didn't become a monk to be exploited as a free labourer. I was really upset. And when you're upset, you can't hide it. You know, it's written all over your body and over your face. So one of these monks, they saw I was upset and angry. And he came up, and this wasn't Ajahn Chah, it was another monk. I don't know who this was, I cannot remember, but my goodness, what he told me was priceless. He said, "Brahma Wangso," that's a full name, not Ajahn Brahm, pushing the wheelbarrow is easy. Thinking about it is the hard part. And then that just hit me just so deep inside, and he was so right. Pushing wheelbarrows is easy, but thinking about it, that was the painful part. And of course, once you understand the problem, you just solve the problem. You didn't think about it anymore. You stopped complaining. And you pushed that wheelbarrow, and it was much lighter, and also the 3 days went past very quickly. And fortunately, I was very pleased that Ajahn Chah was actually satisfied at last, and he never left. That was where the earth stayed, because even that might have been difficult if I carried on again for another 3 days. But I found that whole idea in life, whatever you have to do in life, doing it is easy, but thinking about it, that's the hard part. So I've trained my mind, whatever I have to do, whatever talk you have to do, whatever problem you have to do, whatever event you have to face, you stop thinking about it, you just do it. And yeah, it's really easy then. So it's some of these teachings which you hear, which change your whole life and take away a lot of the difficulty and suffering in life. And just living as a Buddhist in a Western country is a difficult thing. And especially if you're just a lone Buddhist, and the only time you ever meet any other Buddhist, anyone who thinks like you, is when you come to a place like this. And I know this from personal example, because even I was in Sri Lanka the last 12 days, as Dennis was saying, I only came back yesterday afternoon. And there, as a monk, I am not treated like royalty. I'm treated better than royalty. And I was saying that, I mean, because that's what happens when you arrive in Colombo Airport. I'm very well known in Sri Lanka. You don't go through passport control or customs. You get whisked to the VIP lounge. Someone else all does that for you. And you sit there in these nice sofas, and people come and ask, "Do you want a cup of tea or do you want some water?" Does that happen to you when you go to an airport and you're waiting in line for the visas and the customs? And you get taken from this place to that place, you know, and you go and visit the president was, you know, not president of the Buddhist Society, the head of state of Sri Lanka invites you into his palace and serves you baked beans on your plate. "Have you got enough, sir?" How many of you have been served baked beans by a head of state? You know, I'm sure that he doesn't even do that to Queen Elizabeth. You know, Queen Elizabeth comes and visits, you know, she has to help other servants do that for them. But, you know, you get that from the... Because, you know, that's why I say you get treated better than royalty. But, you know, on one of these occasions, somebody asked me in a question time in one of the talks I gave in Sri Lanka. He says, "What's the best way of overcoming conceit, you know, for a Buddhist?" And I said, "Come to Australia." And that was actually a very accurate answer. Because so, you know, you come to Australia, you have to stand in line for hours at Perth Airport. Have you got anything to declare? No. Can I look in your bags? They don't even believe you. And the little dog has to come and poke in your bag and have a sniff around. I'm sure that would never happen to Queen Elizabeth if she came to Perth. I don't think it even happened to Oprah Winfrey. And so you're there, sort of in a place like Sri Lanka, just giving a TV talk, and that was one of the big things, so about 8 or 10 million people audience. And the next day, the very next day, oh no, 2 days later, you're off in our retreat center, getting yourself really dirty, sort of raking earth, because we had to sort of flatten out an area around where the teacher's cottage is going to go on our retreat center. And we've got some bricks. It may have come this afternoon, probably come on Monday. So I had to flatten it all out so you know, the building can proceed. So there you are, one moment, a TV star with 8 and 10 million people watching you for an hour. And the next 2 days later, you're off getting really dirty and dusty, just raking earth. That's why I say coming to Australia is great for Buddhist monks, and you should all come over here. The reason is because in Australia you're not treated as royalty. Sometimes you're not even treated as human beings. Sometimes they look at you and they think you're weird. You're wearing women's clothes. And that's really, really good for your sort of conceit. You experience the extremes as a Buddhist monk here in Australia. And sort of when you go to places like Thailand or Sri Lanka. And because you have those extremes, it's a beautiful practice for us. I love that when I first came to Australia. I remember going to teach in the old Fremantle jail when it was still open. And I thanked those prisoners in that jail because as soon as I walked in to give a talk, and they said, no BS. Unfortunately, I can't say the full word now because people already complain when I use this shit word, which I'm not supposed to say, but I've said it again. But now, this is Australia, okay? We're supposed to sort of teach in the local language. But they said, you know, please, no BS. You know, over in here, if we don't agree with what you say, we're going to tell you. And, you know, that was tough, but it was very refreshing. Because, you know, in some places, like if it's in a church, or if it's in, especially in some of the temples in Asia, a monk or a nun can give a talk, and everyone says, no, sadhu, 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 even if it's a lot of old rubbish. I was told this in Sri Lanka last week, that sometimes people, they don't understand a word of what's said, but they think it's good karma to listen to a talk by a monk, even if they don't understand a word of it. Now, that's superstition. That's not really good at all. I prefer it in a place like Australia, where people will actually criticize you, and rightly so. They'll actually say, that was a terrible, terrible talk. Thank you for giving me the feedback. Because without that feedback, how can we ever grow? And how can we ever do better? How can we actually raise our game and do a better service, a better job? And that's exactly the advice. This is being a monk. This is a similar advice I give to lay people who are Buddhist. It's wonderful. You're so privileged. If you're a Buddhist in a family where no one else is a Buddhist, in a friends who aren't Buddhist at all, in a workplace which they aren't Buddhist, because you really have to get your act together. You have to understand what this teaching truly is. So number one, what I said, don't think about it, just do it. Because as a Buddhist, you know, we should have at least a little understanding on meditation and how to let go of all this thinking, thinking, thinking. What am I going to do? How am I going to do it? What's going to happen? Is this right or that right? How many times have you thought like that, worried yourself sick, and it never ever happens? Always something else happens. It's another great saying of the Buddha. Whatever you expect it to be, it will always be something different. Whatever you expect it to be, it will always be something different. And if there's anyone here who knows their sutras, the teachings of the Buddha, that's from the Sankharupati Sutta in the Majjhima Nikaya. Because sometimes I get criticism, they say, you just make all this up, Ajahn Brahm, it's not really Buddhism. It is actually straight from the word of the Buddha, only sometimes I just put it in modern terms. So whatever you think it's going to be, it's always going to be something different. There's a great teaching as a Buddhist in our modern world. Look, say you're going for the biopsy. Are you worried about, is it going to be cancer, is it not going to be cancer? Please remember that story. Whatever you think it's going to be something different. So you don't know what it's going to be like. No one knows what it's going to be like. So why are you worried about something which you don't know? You don't know how it is. That's actually a great freedom from worry. If you really understand, as a Buddhist, how the future is so uncertain, and just how other people did their cancer, that's not the way you're going to do your cancer. You don't know what's going to happen. So, you can't worry about it. It becomes impossible to worry about it. You just don't know. Let it happen. See what's going to happen next. And that has been my whole life. No, not knowing what I'm going to do next. The last thing I thought I would ever do in life, you know, be sitting in front of a TV camera giving a sermon, you know, live to so many thousands of, millions of people. I never thought I'd do that. I wanted to leave that world. I didn't want to become a celebrity. I just want to become a monk sitting in a cave or a nice forest somewhere meditating, have a wonderful time. That's what I expected as a monk. If you asked me sort of so many years ago where I'd end up, you know, it's no way, you must be mad. Same as you, right now. Where you've ended up now, did you ever expect you'd be sitting on a Friday evening in a Buddhist temple listening to a monk give a talk? It's crazy. So you never know what to expect next. So number one, as a Buddhist in a Western world, let go of all your expectations, anticipations and worries. And then you find it's easy to be a Buddhist in the world. So sometimes you have to go to parties. You know, and you know, it's time of the year, Australia Day, it's just had New Year's Day. I see that one of our members, good old Eddie over there, we just had Happy Christmas and Happy New Year. Now we've got Happy Oz Day over there. It's always happy someday. Sometimes you're going to have Happy No Particular Reason Day. Which would be quite nice. So we're always having celebrations and parties. As a Buddhist, what do we do? And of course, you all know that for New Year I did my Ajahn Brahm's party, you know, because I know sometimes how difficult it is on such occasions. New Year's Eve, you have to go to parties. It's our culture. You know, we want to enjoy ourselves. We want our friends. So what does a Buddhist in the West do you do about this? Let's arrange our own party, which we did, and it was very, very successful. So, you know, invite everybody every year to put that in your diary. Maybe a few years' time, it's getting very popular, we have to restrict it to the A-list. And who is the A-list? You are the A-list. But even if you go to someone else's party, now, I'm saying this because I look back at the time when I was a Buddhist layperson before I became a monk. I know when I became a Buddhist, I didn't know any other Buddhist in the whole country. Now, I was the only Buddhist I ever knew for many years, until I went up to Cambridge University and I found there was a Buddhist society there. And I always remember this experience because, you know, I thought I was the only Buddhist. I didn't know any other temples or anywhere to go to find a Buddhist teacher or anything. I just read a few books and liked it so much I called myself a Buddhist but didn't know what to do next. And when I went up to this university, they had all these different clubs and societies. And I remember just, and so they used to have this society's fair day. Well, all the societies, they had a stall at the university, and you can join whatever club you wanted to. Even fox hunting, if you want to go fox hunting. Remember, this is Cambridge University, snobby place. But as soon as I walked in, I will never forget this experience. They had Buddhist Society of Cambridge University. I saw they had a stall. And to me, that was like finding gold. I never expected they'd have a Buddhist society at a university. So I went straight up to the counter and said, I want to join. And the guy in front of the counter said, look, this is Buddhism. You don't have to join. Just like he, you don't have to join the Buddhist society to come listen to the talks. You don't have to join, you know, to have the tea and coffee and whatever else is here. Because this is our Buddhism. It's like open and free. But I said, no, I want to join. And so I got a pound note out. I want to join. He said, no, you don't have to. Wait and listen to a few talks. See if you like it, first of all. And I said, I want to join. And I had to force a £1 membership fee on him. And he became a lifelong friend. What's his name? Professor Bernard Carr. He's the head of physics at London University the last time I checked in on him. He may have retired now. But he became a lifelong friend. Another physicist as well. It's amazing how many scientists and physicists become Buddhists. But anyhow, that was actually my first introduction to Buddhism. It was great having other friends, so you can actually hang out with each other. But they weren't my social friends. I had your social friends. You know, you had your friends and your girlfriends and others. And I always remember at the end of my 3 years, I asked my friends, just, you know, we were going our separate ways, you know, in the country and in life. I asked, what did you think about me being a Buddhist all those years we were in college together? I remember they answered, said, no, we really respected your Buddhism. I mean, truly respected it. And the main reason for that is you never pushed it down our throats. You never told us about it. You were just a Buddhist, and you never gave us a sermon. You never sort of told us about Buddhism. That's what we respected about you so much. And we saw just how it affected your life. You were a peaceful, calm, happy person. So it wasn't what I said, but who I was and how it changed me. That's what they really respected. And I say that to each one of you as a Buddhist in this world. You know, just don't try converting your family or just, you know, being like some evangelist at work. You know, don't do things like that because you lose respect, and that's not the Buddhist way. Just be you. And if this Buddhism is worth anything, it will change you. And people will see it, and they will respect it. And I say, we're very glad you're a Buddhist. Recently, on one of the retreats which I gave over at Jhana Grove, maybe only a year ago, you know, you always get letters back from people saying thank you. But this letter stood out because the lady said she was from Sydney. She had to sort of scream and struggle and with her boss to try and get the time off. You know, they were busy and getting sort of, you know, 9 or 10 days off work. Now, it's only really 5 days and the 2 weekends. Getting time off work was impossible. And so she really, really had to sort of beg and plead and wear her boss down to actually to go. But she wrote back, when she returned to work the following Monday, she said, the boss, you know, took her aside and said, look, I don't know what drug you were taking over there in Perth, but next time bring me some back. He'd actually seen a change in her, seeing that actually she was a much kinder, happier person. And that is really what this Buddhism should be doing to you. If you're not a happier person, if people don't recognize it, don't come here anymore. It's bad for you. Sometimes you may not be able to recognize it, but the people you live with, now they're the ones who recognize it. They're recognizing that this is doing something really good for you. Another classic story, I don't know if he's here today, but this fellow, he was a Sri Lankan, an engineer working in a government department. And he was what we call Waisak Buddhist. Now, Waisak is the one holy day of the year which is celebrating the birth, enlightenment, and final passing away of the Buddha. So it's like three holidays all in one, but only in one day. And so a Waisak Buddhist is one of these, you know, people born as a Buddhist who only go to the temple one day a year. You know, it's just like a Christian, like an Easter Christian. You know, the rest, they call themselves Christians, but they only go to church one day a year. So this was this guy. But he told me afterwards that his boss was, he coined the word, but I'm sure that you understand this because I've repeated this, the boss from hell. And it's amazing how many bosses are from hell. So he had one of these bosses from hell. And he described him to me, that this boss, you know, would always ask you to do more work. And, you know, you want to help out, you know, so you did do more work. You know, you took the work home and you put in those extra hours and you presented the work to them. It's not good enough. And if it was good enough, okay. And you really work your butt off for some of these people. You know, because you're kind, you really want to do something good, you want to sort of make sure the company or the office actually progresses, there's less problems. You just want to do something good. That's, And you know, what you work for is not just the money at the end of the week, it's job satisfaction. You want to do a good job. So he was trying really, really hard, and his boss would always be angry at him, demanding, always wanting more, always telling him he's not good enough. You know, the boss from hell. But in the space of 3 months, his boss from hell totally changed. And he became, you know, a kind person who's far more sensitive. You know, can you please do this extra work? I know it's a bit extra for you, but would you mind? Instead of, do this. And if he did, I'm really thankful. Thank you for what you've done. We really appreciate you getting the extra hours, and it's really good work. Well done. The boss started praising him. And it was such a clear change of character in this boss that this Sri Lankan guy couldn't help but ask him. He said, look, if you don't mind me saying, boss, you know, you're a bit difficult before. He didn't call him the boss from hell before. You know, you're a bit difficult. And you've actually changed. You're much happier, more peaceful, and you're a much nicer boss to live with. What have you been doing? And the boss said, you know, I'm glad you said that, because many people have been saying the same. And I found this really nice Buddhist temple in Nolamara, and I've been going there learning meditation. And this Sri Lankan man said, that's my temple! But he'd never go here, except on Waisak. Because he was born as a Buddhist. You know, Sri Lankans, Thais, and a Malaysians, Chinese, you're born as a Buddhist. You just, you know, you don't really sometimes appreciate it. But this guy, this Westerner, this Caucasian boss from hell, he came here for 2 or 3 months, and his character's totally changed. And that convinced this Sri Lankan guy to come regularly. He realized something's going on here. And if that's you as a Buddhist in this world, and you do become a happier, better character, people will realize something's going on. Not only will they respect you, but they will also want to share what worked and helped you in your life. So actually you'll be doing something good and kind. So don't go trying to tell people to be a Buddhist or to meditate or to do this and do that, you know, just because, you know, you think it's good for them. It doesn't work. What's another story? There was this Malaysian Buddhist. There was a girl married to an Australian man. And she was trying to get an Australian husband to come here and learn some meditation because she knew her husband would appreciate this. He was stressing out at work. He needed to learn how to relax and let go a bit. And sometimes, you know, his anger would blow up at the most stupid things. She thought if he'd only come and learn a little bit of Dhamma, a little bit of Buddhism, just how to relax a bit and take things easy and don't. Now, people think that Australians take things easy, you know. Maybe there's sometimes they do, but a lot of times they've got short fuses and blow up. So maybe they might take things easy in the pub, but they don't take things easy at home with their wife. But anyway, so she tried to get him to come here, and she would never come. He's one of these Australians who hated religion, like most Australians do. Religion has got a very bad name in Australia. That's why we don't call it religion anywhere. We call it spirituality. You know, doing a makeover, give it a different name. It's not Balga anymore, it's Westminster. That's what people do. So we call it spirituality instead of Buddhism. Because Buddhism means religion, and people hate religion. They think you're going to come in here and you have to give a donation. I'm going to go back to this story about this Malaysian in a minute. But I took a call here once from this Polish Australian. I can never forget this call. She called up and said, are you Ajahn Brahm? I said, yeah, that's me. He said, great, I've got to the right person. Is there going to be a talk tonight? And I said, yes, there's a talk here on Friday night. How much does it cost? And I said, nothing. And she paused and she said, no, you didn't understand me. Maybe you don't understand my English. How much money do you have to pay to get in? I said, madam, you don't have to pay any money to get in here. And there was a longer pause. He said, listen, dollars, cents, how much do I have to cough up to get to the talk tonight? And it was a wonderful conversation because she was serious and she couldn't understand that we do this for free. So I said, madam, you don't have to cough up anything to come up here. You don't have to pay money to get in. We're not going to take your name. We're not going to sort of pressure you for any donation or whatever. You just come in here, sit down. If you like it, fine. You can leave at any time. You don't have to worry about if you get bored during the talk. You can leave. I won't get offended. And then she had this longest pause, and what she said was really from the heart. She said, "Well, what do you guys get out of this then?" And what a beautiful question that was. You know, what do we get out of this? What are these monks who, well, I work my butt off, you know, just don't take any rest, always teaching somewhere or other, you know, 7 days a week, sometimes actually 8 days a week. So working very hard. That's because, you know, jet lag, and sometimes you cross the dateline. Time difference, sometimes it's 8 days a week. So what do you guys get out of this? And of course, this is the other thing about Buddhism. We just do this for the happiness, the service of it. Whenever you give things for others, you always get more happiness and more energy. If you do it for yourself, that's the thing with, if you go to work and you do things, you get tired because it's for money, it's not for goodness, for doing something good in the world. But if you give your time for a cause, for a charity, you know, it's like helping poor kids, or it's helping sort of flood victims in Queensland, or orphans in Bangladesh. If you're doing something which is really good for people, you have all the energy in the world. And this is an important thing to understand. This is why we're doing this. Not for money, but for something which is more beautiful than money. Goodness, energy, happiness, peace. What spirituality was always supposed to generate. You know, I get off on you being happy. I get off when people come up to me and said, "For what you said this evening was so wonderful, it's actually changed my life. You know, I was thinking of committing suicide. I just recalled just last Wednesday giving this big talk for 8,000 people, and this man came up afterwards. He managed to stay behind to catch me. He said, 'Look, 3 years ago, I was going to commit suicide. But I listened to your talk, and it changed, it turned me totally upside down. So no more do I want to commit suicide.' And he had his girlfriend next to me and said, 'We're going to get married soon.' So there you had a guy who was just so depressed and so confused, he was going to kill himself. And now you can see him just with his nice, beautiful wife about to get married. And that just really makes me feel so happy. That there you've actually done something. You've taken a person who's about to destroy their life, and now not only has he got his life back, he's got this beautiful future with a very beautiful, loving wife. You know, shortly. So those are the sorts of things, that's what I do this thing for that sort of happiness. Now you can understand what you can do as well in your life, and that gives you the payback. But anyway, going back to this Malaysian lady who comes here, never get a husband to come here. I say, "Look, it's very easy because I know Australians. You know, I know sort of Westerners, how we work. We got the same. Even though I was born in London, I've been here for so many years now, and you know how people work." So I told her, "Look, if you want your husband to sort of, you know, learn a little bit about Buddhism, don't go around preaching to him. Instead, go and buy one of my books. And when you take it home, just tell your husband, 'Keep your hands off this. This is mine.'" It's obvious, you know. One of the things about Buddhism, because we meditate a lot, we know psychology. You know, we teach it to psychologists, and this is where they get some of their sort of ideas from. And actually, didn't do this last year, but for a couple of years, and next year, or this year. Sort of in August, I'm supposed to give the keynote of this Australian Association of Buddhist Counselors and Psychotherapists, all these psychologists in Sydney who meet together once a year. So they want monks like me to teach them all the tricks so they can actually do their work and be successful and keep some money in Sydney. A lot of crazy people over there. Over here too. But anyway. So I know psychology, and of course it worked a treat. You know, she went back home and said, "No, keep your hands off this. This is mine." Now, if you were a husband, what would you do when you hear that? What does she mean? So as soon as she was out in the shops or somewhere, sort of buying something, and he was at home, he got that book straight away. What does she mean? I can't read this. And of course, he started reading it. And she told me he didn't put it down until he was finished. Now he comes every Friday evening. I don't know if he's here this evening. Maybe, you know, you may come up afterwards and say who you are. But he started coming regularly after that. Because, you know, once he actually saw it, he realized this is good stuff. It really works. And so that this is actually how we can be a Buddhist there. We can actually just show the way just by not what we teach or what we say, but how we say it. And if you have to go to a party, you can still enjoy yourself. And if somebody offers you a drink, say, no, I don't take alcohol. That's what one of the people here told me a long time ago. He came up and said he'd taken his five precepts, was not taking alcohol, and had a lot of trouble the first time that he was a Buddhist. He went to a party, and someone offered him a glass of alcohol. He said, no, no, I can't take it anymore. They said, why? He said, I'm a Buddhist. Oh, you're a Buddhist. We all know about Buddhism. It's all about letting go. Come on, let go. Have a drink. That's what actually happened. So he's in a bit of a trouble there. Because sometimes you have to remember to let go of the right thing, not the wrong thing. So he said he solved the problem. Because again, as a Buddhist, you're innovative. As a Buddhism, we don't just follow just, you know, what it says in the books, you know, like some sort of robot, as if we've been brainwashed. We actually think for ourselves. And that's one of the great things in a religion like Buddhism. You're supposed to think for yourself. So remember, can you all say in unison, we must think for ourselves. No, don't do that. And so this guy was innovative. So he came up, he said, I've solved the problem. I was at a party last week. You know, one of my mates, they came up with some alcohol, come and have a beer. And I said, no, I don't take alcohol. He said, why not? Now, he never said he was a Buddhist. Because Australians, that doesn't work in Australia, okay? So what he said, I can't drink because of doctor's orders. Now, people respect doctors in Australia. Doctors, cricketers and Oprah Winfrey. But actually they don't respect cricketers anymore. But Oprah Winfrey they respect. So if Oprah Winfrey, you can actually say Oprah Winfrey said so. Oh, okay. No, no, no. He said, doctor's orders. I said, oh, okay, fair enough. And then when he came up to see me, he said, I found a solution. I said, hang on. You are keeping one of your five precepts by breaking another. You're lying. There's nothing wrong with you. I know you're perfectly healthy. But because he was innovative, he said, no, I haven't broken my precepts. I haven't lied. And he pointed out, and this is true, in the time of the Buddha, in many of his teachings, he actually compared himself to a doctor. He said, I am a doctor, you know, a doctor which heals suffering in the mind. So he said, no, Buddha was a doctor, so I wasn't lying at all. It was Dr. Buddha's orders. So that's actually how you get around in this Western world. You know, use your intelligence, be smart. So if you want to keep those five precepts and you go to a party or you know go to something on Oz Day, say, no, no, no alcohol because doctor's orders. And they would really respect that. Maybe they may be kinder to you because they think you're dying of some terrible disease or something. So you get a bit more compassion out of them for a change. But the other thing with being a sort of a Buddhist, because most people know us as peaceful, and not just peaceful, but honest people. We've got that reputation, certainly here in Perth. And many, many times, you know, I've met, obviously in my line of work, many people who aren't Buddhists, but they say, oh, you're very peaceful, gentle people, you Buddhists. And maybe that might come from His Holiness the Dalai Lama. Maybe it just might be come by seeing just Buddhism in the world. That it's got a reputation of being gentle and peaceful. So you can do that. You can be a gentle, peaceful person. And then you're very respected in this world. Maybe they may criticize you, because that's what we usually do. You know, we tease each other. We understand how to take teasing. If somebody teases me, I just laugh, because it's something which I heard years and years ago. It's a great piece of Buddhism or teaching. If somebody teases you, or if you make some sort of mistake and people start laughing, you laugh as well. And maybe in a party they tease you for something or other and they start laughing, you laugh as well. And then the world never laughs at you. It only laughs with you. Totally different story. That's why if I ever make a mistake, you know, do something stupid, and people start laughing at me, I laugh as well. So people never laugh at me. I laugh with them. So you laugh with the world, and the world never laughs at you. It's a beautiful thing. So if they make a stupid joke about a Buddhist, you know, then you laugh as well. So don't be so, what's it like, dogmatic, dry, and sourpussed as a Buddhist. I laugh a lot, because then people can never disrespect Buddhism. I was telling people in Sri Lanka, because I think they're a bit upset about some advertisements of people trying to exploit Buddhism for commercial purposes. And I mentioned to them here in Australia, many, many years ago, maybe about 25 years ago, you know, there was an advertisement for this gravy called Gravox. Does it have Gravox gravy? Yeah. We know what the advertisement was. It was on TV. They had this line of Buddhist monks. You know, like us, not Tibetan monks, but, you know, this Theravada, forest monks, a line of monks. And the head monk, apparently he was a dead ringer for my predecessor, Ajahn Chakra, the same glasses, the same face. And the people offered this food, and the abbot looked at the food with great disgust, and it wasn't tasty enough. And from under his robe, he got out a packet, Gravox. And he sent it to the novice, and the novice made up the Gravox, and then the abbot poured it over his food. That was so delicious. He actually, on the TV, he levitated up in the air with bliss. And that was the advertisement. And actually people complained about it. They took it off air. You sow pussies. Because I was going to say, you shouldn't have done that. You should have actually sent for some free samples so the monks could have better food. So if people laugh at us, we laugh with them. And that way that, you know, people, you know, don't feel embarrassed anymore. So remember that also as a Buddhist in this world. You learn to laugh as well, not to take yourself so seriously. And that lack of ego, that lack of conceit, that lack of worrying about yourself, that is what Buddhism is supposed to teaching us. Be more light-hearted, more peaceful, clinging on to less in this world. And so you can go to those parties, you could enjoy yourself. Look, I remember another experience I had which showed me how not to be a Buddhist, you know, in the modern world. And that was, you know, I was a very strict vegetarian before I became a monk. And as a monk, I was not allowed to choose. But when I was a layperson, I was a very strict vegetarian, and my girlfriend invited me out for dinner. She was cooking a dinner for me. So I went out to sort of have the dinner with her, and it was, you know, really like good health food, but she'd made some sort of meat curry. You know, I refused to eat it. And I thought, just what a stupid person you are. There was your girlfriend, and she'd gone to all this trouble trying to cook what she thought you wanted, and I just refused to eat. And if I ever saw her again, I'd say, sorry, 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 I should never have done that. I loved animals, but I hated people. That wasn't being Buddhist at all. So in the world, remember what these precepts, what these rules are there for. It's for compassion, for kindness. So as a Buddhist, I always keep like priorities. What is the most important? You know, and way up there at the top is compassion, truthfulness, honesty. That's way up the top there. You know, much more important than most other things. So as a Buddhist in our modern world, you can still sort of, you know, even cook meat for other people, even though you're a vegetarian yourself. Why? Out of compassion and kindness for people. You're not trying to lay your religion onto others. Not only does that give you a huge amount of respect, people in Australia breathe a sigh of relief. At last there is a real spirituality, which isn't knocking on my door, trying to convince me to be like them. They are loving me for who I am, a meat eater, a drinker, whatever. Which is now the heart of this Dharma, to love people as they are, to love yourself as they are. Instead of always trying to change this world and change people. That's all people really need, a bit of peace, a bit of kindness, a bit of respect. Everyone else is telling you you're wrong, there's something wrong with you. As a Buddhist, we say, no, there's more right with you than wrong with you, so I can still love you whoever you are, whatever you do. Just as I love myself, even though there's many things wrong with me, I can love myself for who I am, in spite of all of my mistakes. That's a beautiful teaching of Buddhism, and spread that in this world. You have a huge amount of traction. People are indulging, they're watching movies and spending too much money. You can still live in that world, but live more simply. You don't have to follow what other people do to gain their respect. In fact, sometimes they respect you more. As again, my friends, when I gave up drinking alcohol, when I lived simply, when I became a vegetarian, they said they respected your strength of mind, that you could say no. But I still went out with my friends to the pub. I only had orange juice. I went to all the parties, but I never got drunk. And I went to the meals, and they sort of gave me special vegetarian food. I could still join in with everything other people were doing. And even though I wasn't indulging like they were, they loved having me around. As I said, I got invited to more parties once I gave up drinking alcohol. More parties. You know why? They wanted somebody sober to drive them home. And that was me. So I had a great time, you know, being the good guy. And people would always trust you. Again, the honesty was an amazing thing. That people look, okay, you're a Buddhist. You're supposed to be honest. And they would trust you where other people wouldn't. You know, you haven't paid the bill yet. Oh, we know you're Buddhist. You'll always pay sooner or later. You know, you're not going to sort of cheat us. I remember just going to our local hardware store in Armidale many years ago. There was all these people there trying to get their stuff, a lot of builders, all Aussies. And I was getting some, I think, Laminex or something. And so I had the brochure. They gave me the brochure, choose your colour, while I went to serve other people. And there were so many people around the counter. It was an old-fashioned shop, you know, not like these big Bunnings, you know, super shops. You know, with a bit of personal service. They gave me the brochure. And I was trying to find a place to put it down and flip through the pages. And so I just went around behind the counter. And the only place I could put it on was, you know, the till, the cash register. It was one of these electronic ones. So as soon as I put it down, I must have pressed the key for opening the cash. So all these, you know, maybe a couple of thousands of dollars worth of cash and takings for the day, they all came out in front of me. And at the same time, you know, in those old-fashioned cash registers, they used to make a ding. Everybody heard the ding, and all these builders and stuff, they stopped talking. Maybe about 20 or 30 of them there, and they all looked at me. And to all extents and purposes, it looked like I was, you know, stealing the whole day's takings. And one of them said to the owner of the shop, he said, look at that guy, you better stop him, he's stealing. And the owner of the shop looked at me, Roy. He said, those guys can't even touch the stuff. They can't even touch money. And he just walks away with total trust that I wouldn't take anything. And I was so pleased with that, that over the years they'd understood enough about Buddhists, and they weren't Buddhists, to trust us implicitly. He could leave his whole takings right in front of me and just turn away. He didn't need to check. He could let me go around the back of the shop, whatever plumbing and stuff I want, just go and help yourself, you can come and bring it back and tell us what you've got afterwards. What a wonderful trust that is. And wouldn't it be wonderful if everybody could do that? If we go into a Bunnings, you didn't need to have a person checking your bags, if you know, security in case you were stealing things. And that's actually the Buddhist, people trust us. And it's a beautiful thing to give that trust in this world. So you say, yeah, I'm a trustworthy person, I'm an honest person, and I'm a kind, I'm a gentle person, I don't do bad things. And being a Buddhist, a real Buddhist, a spiritual person like that in this world, that helps a lot. Because other people, they like having peaceful people around. And especially when there's any problems and difficulties which happen. One of our monks, he was a young monk. His family never wanted him to be a monk. You know, they were Christians mostly, and he was a Buddhist, and he wanted to become a monk, so, you know, he had to argue with his parents. Eventually they let him become a monk, but they didn't like it. And they never really sort of approved until a few years after he became a monk, his father died. And so they invited him back over to Europe, you know, because his father died. And then they found out what he'd been doing. He was so at ease, so in control of the situation. Even though they were Christians, they invited him to do the funeral service. And he did the funeral service for his dad. And what a great privilege that is. And I wish I'd been a monk when my father died. I'd have loved to do that last thing, that last service, you know, for a person you love so much, to do the funeral service. And they were so impressed with him that when he returned, his brother sent a letter to me saying, basically, we never really liked him being a monk, but now we understand what he's been up to, and we appreciate this so much. Please know he's got our full support and respect. And this is what happens. You know, when you really get your act together, you know, most people haven't got their act together. You know that. There's sometimes a little thing like a death and they just go all over the place. A cancer and they go berserk. You know, something wrong happens to them in their life and they just blow out of all proportions. And for real Buddhists, we're at peace with things. Yeah, okay, you know, we live, we die, we've done that many times. Yeah, a child dies, they get reborn again. It's not the end of the world. You know, we can be kind, we can understand, we can know psychology, we can do a huge amount. And even in the offices, it's amazing that if you're a person who's peaceful and kind, people will come up to you when they're in big difficulty. You'll be an ear which they can speak into. And you know you're not there to solve their problems, you're just there to listen, to be passive. And just to love them for who they are. And to love their problems for what they are, rather than always trying to change them and being the one who fixes up other people's problems and fixes up the world and fixes up themselves. You know, a lot of people, that's what we do in life, always fixing things up. And now you may fix things up all your life and they're still not perfect. And after a while you stop fixing things. Instead you love things. So don't be a fixer-upper. Just love your kitchen. The messy old kitchen you already have. And the love sort of your garden, full of weeds and full of sort of brambles and rubbish. And love your husband, wife, full of weeds, full of things which needed changing. I love her for who they are. Love yourself with all your weeds and brambles and, you know, cracked paving bricks or whatever. You get the picture there? Sometimes that we're just so fixer-uppers, we're so fault-finding, we always want to change the world. And as a Buddhist, if we can be a kind, peaceful person, then you can change the world. It's good to change the world, but we don't know how to change the world. When people go in to change the world, they usually make it much worse. They try and change their partner, and they make them much worse, they end up getting divorced. They try and change themselves, and they get psychotic. Don't try and change yourself. You're absolutely beautiful as you are. Unless you know that, and I'm not just saying that, unless you understand that, you'll never find any peace in this world. Change your attitude. Don't change yourself. Change your attitude to your husband, to your wife. Don't change them. As I keep on saying, if you get a new husband, a new wife, one thing I'll guarantee, they're all the same. So stick with the one you've got. And change your attitude and change the person. Going to work, doing a job, it's all the same. So don't try and change the job. Change your attitude. You can do things like that. And life itself. Change your attitude and then it becomes a peaceful, beautiful world. So this is just what we do as a Buddhist in our modern world. It's got a huge amount to give. And all the problems which we sometimes face, you know, what am I going to do today? How am I going to sort of not go to this party? Go to the parties, go to the functions. But be your own peaceful Buddhist self. You don't have to indulge. And actually you can find that you're so valued there. You keep people cool. You stop people doing stupid things. They respect you because they respect your strengths. You know, one great thing about the Western countries, people respect your independence to choose to do what you want to do. So I'm a Buddhist, this is my right in Australia. They respect that. And after a while, it's more than respect. Sometimes they see the benefits and they want to do the same things themselves. So some of my friends went to see one of my friends I'd never seen for 40 years, and he's become a Buddhist. And I asked him, was it because of you? He said, well, some of the example of your life, not what you said, but how you were, that did change me. He was a professor of math somewhere. So all these people, this is, if it really works, it will change you, and you'll find it easier to live anywhere in this world, no matter who you're living with. Even if you're a bikie, or if you are, a prostitute, if you are a film star, if you are, I don't know what else you are in this world, it should make you a happier, more peaceful person. Why not? So we can have Buddhists all over the place. I'm not talking about just getting numbers. I'm talking about kinder, more peaceful, more wise people. And that way, we're not just living in the world, we're actually contributing to it. Because they always say, how many people do you meet in life? Every one of those people that you affect, you change slightly. So if you're a kind, peaceful, kind, compassionate person, that's what you're giving to others in this world. You're actually doing something, you're changing other people. So it's great being a Buddhist in this world. It's tough, but it stops you being lazy. Like I see sometimes in Sri Lanka, in Thailand, in Burma, some of these Buddhist countries, because everyone's a Buddhist there, it's no challenge, you don't grow so much. But being a Buddhist in a country like Australia, you are challenged. Really, you have to be a real Buddhist, not one of these ceremonial Buddhists. Because people will rightly criticize you for that and take that criticism because it's a stupid thing to be. So if you're going to be a Buddhist here in Australia, be the real one. Not sticking on a ceremony, but doing the practice. Being virtuous, being kind, being generous, being wise, rather than just playing around. And that way, living as a Buddhist in a place where everyone else is not a Buddhist is a wonderful way of living. Why not? You don't have to be like everybody else. As the old saying goes, and I'll finish off now, where everybody thinks the same, no one thinks at all. Thank you for listening.